Let's speak to the man himself. Evzy, hello. Have you had a good week?
Good morning. Yes, I've had a week full of gadgets, surprisingly.
Really? Yes. And excited. Has it been a good... Yeah, we're not going to reveal your gadgets of the week just yet.
No,
we can get
no.
people wait for let them wait for that. But has it been a good week? An exciting one?
Yeah, it has been a good week. There's been some nice news stories as well, some nice technological breakthroughs, and some of them sort of very important, like battery technology and how they can make batteries that won't burst into flames. And there's another story which I loved, which is a sort of more of an engineering story, really. But an engineer's won an award for coming up with clothing that grows with children.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I wish I could have some of that for my kids.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, the thing is, the challenge will be trying to find manufacturers that are going to want to make that.
Yeah, because I suppose you prefer...
They make a lot of money.
Yeah. You prefer to have all those clothes, children growing out of those clothes and moving into another one. But I suppose when you have technology like that, you will eventually find someone who may be willing to take a chance on it. Maybe somebody who's not in the children's clothing business at the moment.
Exactly. I mean, it could be a disruptive technology. You know, as they say, the truth will out. Well, I think designs like this will out eventually. But no, it's quite cleverly done. What they've done is, as I say, it's an engineering. I thought at first when I saw the headline, oh, well, they found a way to make it sort of grow organically or something, like a skin or something. But actually, it's kind of clever. It's kind of just ruffled in a way, and you can actually, if the child isn't wearing, say, the trousers, you can actually just pull them and it will just grow, and it just the kinks and so forth just come out of it. So it does have a certain look to it, because in its small phase it's quite kinked, as it were, if you can imagine, just ridges in it. But as the child grows in girth and length, it unkinks itself and grows. And they think that one garment, for example, could fit a child from the age of 6 months up to 3 years.
That's incredible, isn't it?
By which time the child will be truly fed up of it and be trying to set fire to it, I suspect. But it does remind me, I had a pair of shoes once as a child that would not wear out, had a polyurethane sole, and I used to sit on the back, I'm not suggesting to anyone, sit on the back of a bus and drag my feet trying to wear the beggars out, and it never used to happen.
So, I think we've all done that, haven't we? Parents giving us those clothes we don't like, and we try and get rid of them one way or the other. Fevzy, I'm sure that wherever you go, you know, if you're going out for an evening, you bump into people, even your friends, they must be constantly asking you questions about technology. What are the sort of standard questions you get, or what areas are people asking you the most about nowadays?
Well, it is interesting, because it's changed a lot over the years. It wasn't so many years ago. It was, you know, and we still do get, but it was my Windows PC and my Windows PC that. It's more now my smartphone. What do I choose? You know, Apple or Android phone. It doesn't do this. How do I set that up? This setting doesn't do what I thought it would. But also, increasingly now, questions about privacy and, in particular, security as well. So people are starting to become aware that these mobile devices carry, you know, everything. They're not just obviously not just phones anymore, but they're computers that have our whole life's information potentially on them, but are very vulnerable, both in terms of the fact that they're small and easily stolen or broken, all the way through to hackable, and because they're connected and often always connected, in a sense harder to protect. And I think the security software on smartphones and tablets is a little bit behind the curve, as it were. So people are getting concerned about that as well. But I think that's a good concern. It's not that I wish to scare people, but it's good to understand, you know, how powerful that device is, but also what the responsibilities of safeguarding that information are as well.
Well, it's always good to have questions asked, isn't it, Fevzy? And you can put your questions to Fevzy on 08085 909 693. Calls are free from mobiles and landlines. You can also text 85058, text charged at your standard message rate. There's also an email, which is upallnight@bbc.co.uk. So lots of ways to get in touch. And you're willing to answer everything and anything, aren't you, Fevzy?
Give it a go, yes.
Yeah, why not? Now let's talk about a cyber incident. There seems to be one every week, but the Equifax one has affected millions and millions of customers.
Yeah, so about 143 million customers, almost all of them in the US, but not all of them, some of them in the UK as well. So Equifax is one of the main credit referencing agencies. It holds a lot of sensitive information about us and, you know, is the organization to which other organizations to go to find out how creditworthy we are or are not. And therefore, again, is, you know, in a sense, potentially the crown jewels of the information that could be used to steal our identities and take mortgages in our name and the whole thing. They've just admitted earlier this evening to a huge cybersecurity breach. They said that information was accessed by criminals, including people's social security numbers, dates of birth, addresses, mostly in America, but also customers here and in Canada as well were affected. And they say that this access took place between the middle of May and July when the company discovered the breach. And of course, the first thing to say about that is, if the company discovered the breach in July, why are we just finding out about it now?
So why are we just finding about
I don't know, because they're saying, well, we're offering free credit monitoring to identify identity theft. Now, they've recognised the fact that some of that information that has been stolen could enable people to steal our identities or take out loans in our name and so forth. And yet from July to September, it seems. And also just think about the scale of that, 143 million. Isn't that about half the population of the United States? I mean, one person in two has had their information leaked, essentially, in the US. I mean, that's a frightening figure in and of itself, I think. It is one of the largest breaches that's ever reported. One thinks there may be other breaches that haven't been reported, but and they apologise. But the other thing to say about this is for them to talk about this information having been accessed, that means that information was accessed in a way that the thieves can read the information. That's to say, it wasn't properly encrypted. It wasn't properly scrambled, it would seem, because otherwise they wouldn't be talking about it in these terms.
Is that what generally companies do? They scramble that information so that even if somebody does access them, it means that maybe a lot of that information is not useful for them.
Well, exactly. In fact, in this country, if data is properly encrypted, that's to say properly scrambled, and it's then stolen, it's not even considered as having been stolen because the data is unintelligible. It's just gobbledygook. And properly encrypted data, you know, is of no use to the thief. So it seems that parts of their data, at least, were stored in the open. I'm surmising, but as I say, it really wouldn't be considered to be a breach if the data were secure, because it would be of no use to anyone. The fact that they're offering people free credit monitoring tells us the fact that some of that data, at least, was in a potentially usable form, and that has got to be worrying. And you know, it's ironic that this particular organization that does what it does has been breached in this way. And it tells us that we have to be very careful about what data we leak around. Of course, with a credit reference agency, it's impossible to keep your data off those, and it's not even necessarily desirable, because when you need to, you know, open an account or take a loan or a mortgage, that's the first thing that they check. So you need that, but then it's incumbent upon them to protect that information properly. And I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't hear from regulators from around the world about what they're doing and how they've done it.
You can get in touch with Fevzi on 08085 909 693 or text 85058 or email uplnight@bbc.co.uk. Chris has phoned in from Yeovil in Somerset. Chris, what would you like to ask Fevzi?
Hello, I'd like to ask, I've got a problem. I've got a Dell desktop, Optitex, 7, let me just check the number, it's 7, it's an Optitex, yeah. 750, 760.
Okay.
What's happened is, it just, like, sort of froze, and it's just making a noise. There's two lights come on, 2 and 4, and it's just going like that. It goes to fire up, and then it just won't.
Right, okay.
It just won't fire up at all.
And those noises that it's making, Chris, would you say they're mechanical noises in nature or electrical? Does it feel like something? For example, are you familiar with the noise of a hard drive inside a computer?
No, I'm not very technology. That's the problem.
All right. So. And does it sound like it's something physical making the noise, or does it perhaps sound like some sort of electrical squelch?
Yeah, it sounds like a squelchy sort. That's how it sounds. It goes. Yeah, like a squelchy.
Okay.
It's hard to describe, but.
Okay.
Well, you're describing it pretty well, actually.
Yeah. So, Chris, whatever the cause, this is a cause for concern. The risks are, first, to your data, and secondly, is the machine actually safe? I'm assuming this is quite a few years old, this machine, is it?
It's 3 years, 4 years.
What version of Windows is it?
Maybe a bit older than that.
Yeah, what version of Windows is it running?
I'm using 10.
10. Do you know what it was originally on there?
8.7 it was.
Okay.
Vista it was originally.
Yeah. Okay, and does it ever start up now, or is it completely non-functional as far as getting it up running and working is concerned?
We can't get it up running as such. It just still makes that noise. I put it on the other day. I thought I'd leave it a couple of days, as you do.
Yeah.
And it still did the same. And it's happened before.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like that for ages, and then it sorted itself out. But it's done it again, and I'm like, it's ridiculous because I can't get stuff out,
No, that's right. And is there, forgive me asking all these questions, but is there information on there that is not backed up and that you would want to keep?
No, well, not all of it, really, to be honest. I could afford to lose it if I could find a way of getting it sorted,
I understand. All right. I think because it's hard to identify what that noise is, I think it would be good to take that to an independent repairer and just ask them to have a listen to it at least, because they, once they hear that noise, they will be able to tell, for example, if it's the hard drive. See, if it's the hard drive and the hard drive starts up occasionally, that would be an opportunity to copy off the data before it died completely. And the fact that it sort of happened before and it's come back again might suggest that it's a physical problem. The reason I'm also saying to you, for a repairer to look at it is because it's possible that you've got an electrical fault. There are some faults, for example, with the main power supply of the unit that could give rise to similar sounds, and that could even be a fire risk. So I think instead of taking you through basics of trying to work out what it is from here and you struggling with it and it being switched on and plugged in, I think you need to go to a local independent repairer and just ask. I mean, just take the machine in if you can and ask them what it would cost to diagnose that problem and to fix it. And perhaps my suspicion is that even on first listen they will have a good idea where the problem lies and give you an indication of whether that's going to need a new hard drive or a new power supply or whether something else is going on. But I wouldn't leave it, unattended. I wouldn't leave it plugged in either. I would try and find, someone who's going to look at it. And often people will not charge for a first look. They'll say, this much, this is what I think it might be, and this is what it would be to fix it, and if it's that, it'll be this much. And then you can decide before committing any money as to whether you want them to go ahead and do the repair. I think if you were to send it back to Dell, that's probably going to be expensive, both in terms of shipping repair costs, but I would take it to repair at this point because it's possible there's a dangerous fault with it. Sorry to say, Chris, but it is by that sort of noise is not normal and it is worrying me. So do get it checked out, please.
Let's go to John in Whitehaven in Cumbria. John, you've got a question for Fevzi about smart TVs.
Yes, the BBC announced that. If you had a smart television, it could be hacked in the room if you were in conversation or receiving a phone call. Was that, and especially that Samsung were vulnerable?
Yeah. So, John, I mean, this is potentially true. So this is not just all smart TVs. What they're referring to is TVs that have either microphones and or cameras built into them, and some of the high-end smart TVs have that. So we're not really talking about the TVs that have the ability to run, you know, things like YouTube and so forth. That's not enough. Yes, they are internet connected and, you know, could potentially be hacked, but if you're talking about them spying on you by listening to your conversations and watching you, then they would have to have a microphone or a camera. But they do. And the reason why smart TVs can have microphones and cameras built into them is because they've built some special functions into them. Some of them allow you to do things like video Skype and video telephony. Others allow you to give them voice commands. Others detect you moving your arms, you know, motioning arms and creating gestures in front of the TV.
Are all these going to be standard soon on TVs, do you think?
I don't know that it will be standard, but it's certainly becoming more common because it's cheaper to do. It's a sort of, it's a technology in search of a problem sometimes, I do think. But the problem is that, so for example, with some of the Samsung TVs, and this is not just a Samsung issue, but Samsung TVs have, some of them have voice activation, so you can give them voice commands. And like a lot of devices that have voice input, the processing of the voice is not done on the device itself. It's sent over the internet, which is the same as, you know, when you speak to Siri or when you speak to, you know, Google Now or even, you know, Amazon Alexa, right? I've woken up all three sets of machines now. With those, your voice, what you say, a recording of it is sent away. And that's part of the terms and conditions. If you read the terms for that feature, then you have to consent to your voice being sent away. Now, that's, and often Samsung, you know, companies don't do that processing themselves. So it's already getting shipped off to a third party, which will interpret what was said and then send back instructions to the TV telling it what to do in response. So the TV is really eyes and ears in that sense. It doesn't have the brain. But the problem is, first of all, you know, your voice is being sent away. Is it listening when you're not trying to give it a command? Is your conversation in the room being sent away? So there are those sorts of issues. The other issue is if that computer, and effectively is a computer, that television set, if it is hacked, then it's possible to get the camera to switch on when you're not aware of it being switched on, or the microphones to be on when you're not aware. And that in and of itself is an issue. So yes, there is a potential for that. If you think you will benefit from the features that are provided by having a camera in there, then go ahead and buy one. But if you are at all concerned that this may be happening, then don't. There are plenty of TVs that don't have those facilities. But there are some nice features. Like, for example, the camera will detect, and the camera and the microphone will detect when it thinks you're asleep and turn itself off.
Oh, that is useful, isn't it?
So, yeah, it is. It sort of detects lack of movement and so forth. How long before it calls the emergency services, I wonder. But, TV's getting smarter.
But they get smart enough that, you know, if you're talking rubbish, they could turn themselves off.
I sincerely hope not.
or turn you off. That could be better.
No, I don't think so. But, I mean, this idea, I mean, we've got these things like Amazon Echo boxes, and we've got, you know, Siri and Google Now built into our phone where we can talk to our devices, and now these home devices. And I think that technology will increasingly be built into TV sets or at least be accessible, TV sets be accessible via them. So this idea that we can control our homes with our voice, I think, is a powerful one. And as that goes forward, it's going to be harder and harder to avoid this. I mean, you can unplug a sort of Amazon Echo box, but if the technology is built into your fridge, you can't really unplug that. So as time goes by, this technology will become more ubiquitous. But if you want to hold back the tide and be King Canute, then I think for the time being, at least we can do that.
Let's go to Steve in Bristol, who's been extremely patient. Thanks for your patience, Steve. What would you like to ask Febzy?
I'm sorry to go back to something I spoke to you both about a few months ago, SSD drives.
Yep.
I've got a very aging PC, and my hard drive has held up for all of these years. Mm-hmm. So I know I need to replace it. What I wanted to ask was, if I bought an external SSD drive, sort of a backup drive, mm-hmm. obviously download everything off my current hard drive onto the SSD drive, and then my internal drive failed, could I run the PC off the external SSD drive?
Which operating system are you running?
Windows 7.
Windows 7. So, and what you're saying is, could you create a drive that could be booted externally, or you mean at that point, could you install the SSD and run it like that?
Well, I'm assuming you can't take the external drive and then fit it internally.
Well, yes, potentially you can, actually. So when you do a backup, there's different ways of backing up. You can just back up files that you think, you know, you don't want to lose and be able to reinstate those files. But you can also do a bit-by-bit copy of an entire hard drive or a partition of a hard drive. And that means that you've then got the operating system as well. You've got a carbon copy of that drive, and so to all intents and purposes, if one drive were to fail, you could physically install the SSD drive. The computer, is it a laptop or a desktop computer?
Oh, desktop.
It's a desktop. So what you could do is, instead of going the external route, you could actually get an SSD and install it inside the computer. And so let's say, you know, your main drive was a C drive, this one, and you've got a CD-ROM as well, which is D, this one could become the E drive. And then it's, you know, it's simpler. You don't have to plug in anything externally. You can still back up to that drive and keep copies of it. The downside of having it internally is if, for example, God forbid, but if the machine was stolen, or suffered an electrical failure, then that backup could be affected. But it is, whether it's internal or external, it's possible to make a bit-by-bit copy. Now, if you've done it to an external drive, well, what you've then got is a file that contains the whole partition or the whole drive's data. You could then reinstate that to a new internal drive. So you wouldn't necessarily have to strip the physical external drive from its casing and then put it in. What you would do is have the data that was required to reinstate it onto another internal drive. But my suggestion would be not to wait for that mechanical drive to fail. If it is several years old, with mechanical drives, it's not a question of if they fail, it's when they fail, and the trick is to be ahead of the game. So my recommendation to you would be this: to replace the internal drive with a fast SSD drive, and they are all fast compared to the old one. Make sure it's got sufficient capacity for what you need it for, and then if you want a backup external drive, then that one I would say, you know, I would go for a non-SSD based one, but a traditional one, because SSDs, although they've become a lot cheaper, much, much cheaper than they used to be, at the top end of the capacities, the conventional drives are still cheaper and much cheaper. So, and that's really the only reason, in my view, that they still exist, because you can get, you know, 3, 4, 5 terabyte drives for not that much money, which would mean there's enough capacity to take multiple backups of the data, you know, so you could keep the backups and be able to roll back to particular dates without just having one backup. So I would suggest doing it that way. Go for an internal SSD now, do that transfer, and then buy yourself a conventional external hard drive. Does your computer have a USB 3 port on it? If it's that old, it won't have had one as standard, but you can, if it's a desktop, you can add a USB 3 card into the device as well. And the reason I say that is because a lot of modern drives will use USB 3. They will work with USB 2, so they'll be what they call backward compatible. But, you know, the backups will take longer to make because they're that much slower.
Fefty, for those of us who are not as technology-minded as yourself, how will you know if it's USB or USB 2 or 3 on it?
Okay, so
will it be just when you plug in your device you'll be able to tell?
No, there is a way that you can usually tell if you peer at them. So USB sockets are the little rectangular sockets that you often find, you know, at least two or three of on a computer. And they're about, you know, a centimetre and a half wide and about three-quarters of a centimetre high. And inside the USB 3 ones, almost always, there are some exceptions, you see a little bit of blue plastic inside, that tends to tell you that you're looking at a USB 3 connector. There are other ways where you can interrogate the hardware that's inside a machine, and it will show you whether you have USB 2 or 3 interfaces. Often on machines, you also find a combination. But for an older machine like Steve's, my thought will be it's almost certainly, you know, USB 2, which is fine. It just will do the job. It will just be slower. But, you know, for a backup, that's not necessarily the end of the world. At some point, you may, you know, spend a few pounds and insert a USB 3 card into your desktop. And that is the joy of having desktops, of course, is that, you know, they are large Meccano sets and you can bolt pretty much whatever you want into them. So they have a longer useful life for that reason. You know, if the graphics circuitry goes, you can plug in a new graphics card. If the keyboard goes, you can replace that. If the screen goes, you can replace that. So it is a modular design, and that's the joy. It's not obviously portable, but it has those benefits. But Steve, if you're still on the line, internal SSD now before the drive fails, copy across everything. You can use software built into Windows, or you can use specialist third-party software such as Acronis True Image Pro, which does some very nice backup facilities with that. And then in short order, buy yourself a large backup drive, of at least a terabyte, which is 1,000 gigabytes.
Steve, does that answer your question?
That's very useful. If I can just go back to the USB port thing, if I can.
Please do.
Right, you said USB 2, USB 3.
Yeah.
My PC is so old.
It might be 1.1.
Was there such a thing as USB 1?
There was, and there was USB 1.1, which is more ubiquitous. You will lose the will to live if you wait for a USB 1 drive to copy across the contents of your hard drive. But it's functional. It will work. My advice is when you buy the external drive, still buy, if you can, a USB 3 drive, because it will even work with 1.1. It will just be slower. And then in the future, if you need to use that drive with a more modern computer, or you decide to upgrade the connectivity on your existing computer, then you will reap the benefits without having to buy a new drive. Whereas if you go, you can't buy a USB 1.1 drive now, I don't think, not easily. But if you went out and bought a USB 2 one, then if you did upgrade to 3, you're not going to get the benefit, because you'll then have to replace the drive as well to get the higher speeds. You know, that's it. And also at some point, if you upgrade the operating system, that will give you access to higher speeds as well. You may need to do that. So that's the advice. But I think the best bit of that advice, as I say, the most important bit, is to not wait for that hard drive to fail and to replace it with whatever you're going to replace it with, but in this case, an SSD. And I would say, in terms of capacity, I wouldn't go anything smaller than 256 gigabytes, because you're going to need enough space on the main drive, what's the boot drive, if you like, where the operating system sits. The operating system itself needs a certain amount of storage, both to store the operating system and to have some working area. If you need a lot more storage internally, and I'm guessing you probably don't because it's an older machine, I guess the drives are not that huge, but if you needed that, you can internally mount a fast solid state drive SSD as your boot drive. So that will give you most of the benefit. But if you needed to store a lot of information internally, there's nothing to stop you fitting a second conventional spinning hard drive internally. But I suspect you could just get a 256 and cope with that quite comfortably given the age of your machine.
Steve, thank you very much for your call. If I have a quick question for USB 1, USB 2, USB 3, what sort of differences in speed are we looking at between them?
Oh, between 2 and 3, from tens to hundreds. So, you know, an order of magnitude difference. There are, I mean, those are theoretical differences. In practice, they won't necessarily be that huge because the speed of data transfer is only as quick as the slowest link in the chain. So if, for example, you've got a very slow internal hard drive that you're copying from, but a very fast new drive that you're copying to, the speed will be limited by the speed at which that data can be read by the older drive. Similarly, if that situation was reversed and you were trying to copy onto an old drive from a very fast SSD sitting on a USB 3 port, the problem with that is that, you know, you'll be limited by the speed at which the older drive can write. So there can be limitations. And also, if the processor is underpowered, if there's not enough memory, all of these factors can affect the speed that you get. But the reality is it will be a few times faster. It might not be 10 times faster, but it will be a few times faster and it will be noticeable. And particularly if you're doing full backups, so not just backing up incrementally the differences, but the initial backup of everything, you know, that could take a very long time over a slower connection.
Are we near USB 4?
No, we're kind of 3.1, 3.2, because USB sockets are changing. So at the moment, we use USB A and B, which are, you know, the thin one and the fat one that go into the back of a printer typically. We now have USB C, which is a smaller connector. It has the benefit of you can turn it round and use it either way. So it's a symmetrical connector. And that connector can carry potentially much higher speeds and can carry different types of things. So you can get different transfer methods. Like there's a standard known as Thunderbolt, which we're up to Thunderbolt 3 on that, and it's possible to carry different standards of communication with the one connector. So if, for example, you look at some of the new Apple MacBook computers and MacBook Pro computers, they will come, well, the MacBook just has one USB-C connector and it can do many different things, although without an adapter, only one of them at a time. So you can charge the device via the USB-C connector. You can use it to, you know, plug in an external mouse or keyboard, or you can use it to connect to a video display as well. So it carries, it becomes this sort of truly ubiquitous thing where it can carry all sorts of different types of information, be it video information or audio, anything you like, but much more quickly. So not so much USB 4 as USB-C, and then all the complicated versions of USB-C that will, yeah, USB-C is the physical connector, but there's different types of data that can flow through it. So that's where we're going with all this. It's a kind of transitional phase at the moment because there aren't that many USB-C peripherals out there. So people are often having to get little adapters now for their MacBook Pros and other, you know, bleeding edge computers whereby they can plug in their existing peripherals into a device that has only one or more USB-C sockets and no conventional USB sockets. So we're in that sort of transitional phase at the moment.
You can call Fevzi 08085 909 693. Calls are free for mobiles and landlines. You can text 85058 Jeff and Dan Haven. We will be getting to those texts very shortly. Of course, you can email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. But Martin from Devon has called in. Martin, and you've got a pretty interesting question for Fevzi.
Yes, I have. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Martin.
I'm sat in my lounge and in darkness because I'm blind, and we're all waiting. And when I say all of us, every month I go with a group of guys, we're all blind, and we all have the same complaint. Why don't they make a mobile phone for blind people? Now, Rob, who's a friend of mine, who said, my God, I wish I had my sight. I said, why, what would you do, Rob? I'd go straight into the Dragon's Den, I'd corner the market. 300 million phones could be made and sold overnight. Because worldwide, there's a good 300 million people who are blind that would like a mobile phone where they don't need a screen. They don't need emails. They don't need texting. They just want one. If all that's taken away, it just puts more room in the phone for other things that we could use. And what he wants is speech dial. the same as I would want. Hmm. It's a directory which you speak into it. You say Sainsbury's, Tesco's, the doctors, dentists, and it dials it.
Yep.
He said the technology is there, but nobody's making a phone for blind people.
Sure. Martin, that technology does exist within most smartphones. Some of it works better than others. It's what manufacturers call accessibility options, typically. So if, for example, you buy an iPhone, it has the ability to read to you anything that's on the screen. You simply just swipe down with two fingers and it will read to you the contents of the screen. Voice dialing exists via Siri or Google Now for Android phones. You can do these things. There are issues with how easy they are to set up. But and you know, I'm not a blind person, so I can't speak from experience, but I do know that blind people do use these phones successfully. I don't think they're necessarily optimal yet, but they do have the voice dialing. So if I say hey, and then Siri, if I say hey Siri, and then it wakes up, and then I can say call such and such, and it will call them. You know, sometimes it's not perfect, sometimes it mishears.
Yeah, but at the moment there are only about four or five numbers you can get on a phone, isn't there?
No. If you've got a smartphone with, you know, you can have thousands of entries in the contacts list, and you can, as long as you allow it to have, you know, the voice activation switched on, because that's an option some people choose.
Well, you know, the same question has been asked by the Canadian National Institute for the Blind. They've got blind people as well. They get the same questions asked. Do you need to spend all that money and all that high-tech stuff in a phone when none of us can use it? I mean, we don't need emails because we can't see a screen. You could take the screen away. You could take the email away. You could take the calculator away. In fact, if you take most of the rubbish out of it, well, I wouldn't say it's rubbish, but you take most of the features out of a phone, which wouldn't benefit a blind person, and replace it with things which would. There's an instant market, I'm told, for 300 million phones worldwide. That's the last count.
It sounds like a big market, Fevzi. I mean, it sounds like it's something that people could... I mean, Martin's making a lot of sense.
I think the way that this is going is that the smartphones that have that technology that I've mentioned to you are getting cheaper, not necessarily the Apple ones, but certainly the ones that are running Google's Android operating system. And, you know, there are blind people who use text messaging and email because they use screen readers. They use voice input and screen readers. So it will read the message to the person as it comes in, or as they interrogate the messages. So, you know, the problem, I guess, is by the time you build that capability into a non-smartphone, if what we often call feature phones, you've ended up putting in most of the technology, other than perhaps a big screen, that you would need to have a smartphone.
But
anyway,
what Martin, I think, is asking for is not a smartphone, is he?
He
doesn't want
not a smartphone, because as you say, you can get all those features in there. But the thing is, a blind person cannot use email. A blind person cannot necessarily use text. When I go to meet with all my friends once a month, they all have the same complaint.
Mm.
They don't want the calculator. They don't want... they'd like a speaking clock. They'd like features which would suit a blind person, where it's all done by speech dial. Having anything on a screen is a waste of time for all of us. So why not make a phone, as he said, Rob said, give me the chance to get into the Dragon's Den. I said, would you, Rob? He said, if I had my sight, I'd go to the Dragon's Den and I would get immediate financing. Because nobody else is doing it. Set up a business where you make phones just for blind people. There'd be a market for at least 300 million worldwide.
You and Rob should do it, Martin.
Well, it's nice, but he hasn't got the money, nor have I. But I'm
maybe somebody. Maybe. But can I ask you, Martin, if smartphones became a lot cheaper, and I know they'd have a lot of functions that you wouldn't want on there, but if they had that one function that worked for you, would you be happy with that, I suppose, put up with it?
Well, that's the same. Yes, it is, because it's the same question which is asked by Action for Blind. What kind of a phone do you want? Because I was hoping that the RNIB would push this issue. I mean, we're just about to leave Europe. We're exiting the European community. We're looking for entrepreneurs to start up new businesses. Maybe Mr. Dyson, who makes the vacuum cleaner, could then start making smartphones for blind people. Specifically for blind people. So there's no calculators, there's no emails. It's a £300 million sorry, 300 million marketplace. Yeah.
And they should be cheaper to make, shouldn't they, Fevzi?
Well, if you take all the nonsense out that a blind person can't use, yes, it would be, because you could make more space for speech dial. So at the moment, I believe you can only get 5 or 6 memorized speech dials in there. There was a phone told to me at the meeting the other week. What's it called? I forget now. But it's one that's easier to use. But it's the one the RNEIB say is the only one that's at the moment available for blind people that's any use.
Was it from a manufacturer called Doro?
It is. Sorry, yeah. That's the one, Doro.
Yeah. So Doro are, I think they're Swedish or Finnish. They're a manufacturer who produce phones that are easier to use, and not just for blind people, but people who maybe have vision impairments or don't need a lot of features. So it basically blocks off a lot of the features. But ultimately, you know, smartphones are getting cheaper, and it's possible to get those features and just ignore those that you don't want.
Before you tell us your gadget of the week, how many gadgets do you go through before making your decision? This week, how many have you had to look at?
20. I've been probably working with about 20 gadgets this week. That what I try and do is use them on an ongoing basis to just, you know, try not to give an opinion after 5 minutes, but actually use them, which is quite chaotic, particularly when it comes to smartphones and so forth, because I'm using a different phone almost every week now. So
that must be annoying sometimes.
Well, it is, because, you know, trying to keep the phone functional and, you know, how much of it are you going to customize and set up for your needs and so forth, and before you have to swap it again. But that's really the best way to understand devices. But I guess also, because I've seen so many devices now, you know, I can get a pretty good idea of whether this is worth persevering with, you know, before taking a lot of time with it. So there's a lot of devices that if I say the wrong thing, they wake up and start. and believe me, before we do this program, I it's like, you know, a clockmaker trying to switch off all their clocks, you know, but I have to go around and try and ensure that everything is silenced or off. And it takes some time.
You should leave some of them on. It could be quite entertaining, I think. But are there some gadgets that you go get in a week and you just think, oh, no, that's just not ever going to work? Or generally, are we looking at stuff now that's all pretty functional?
No. There's a lot of old tosh out there, frankly, as well. And what I do is I encourage companies not to send me things without talking to me first. And I only really invite in the things.
If you didn't, could we be looking at a lot more than 20?
Well, I just wouldn't have the time or inclination to look at them, because the thing is, what I do is I do pre-vetting, if you like, of a gadget. So that gadget has to look good on paper to me before I will request it for review. And as I say, I have enough experience to be able to tell whether something is likely to be good. Sometimes you get caught out. Sometimes something is good on paper, but the implementation is flawed in some important
way.
Sounds
like my football team, to be perfectly honest with you.
So that can happen, but it's rarely the other way round. Things are rarely appalling on paper, but turn out to be devilishly clever. So, it's sometimes you get disappointed, but that's what the evaluation process is for. So by the time something comes to be a gadget of the week, it's sort of gone through both stages of being good on paper and being good in practice as well.
So what was the gadget? What is the gadget of the week? The one that's really caught your attention?
Sure. Okay. So we're used to these sort of rugged cams that people, you know, strap onto their mountain bikes or on their helmets, or put, you know, take underwater and film, you know, fish with, and all the rest of this, these sort of action cams, as they're called. This one is an unusual one. It's from a company called Kit Vision, and it's called the Immerse 360 Duo. And the unusual bit is the duo bit, because actually it's two cameras back to back. Each camera has a 180 degree field of view. So actually this thing shoots in 360. It shoots everything all the way around it all the time. So it can record in full high definition, that's to say 1080p, but in 360. So you can, for example, you can put it on a handheld stalk, hold it like that, and it will just film everything around you. So it will film what's in front of you, what's behind you, what's to the side of either side of you, all the way around. And then there's an app where you can have interactive playback of these three-dimensional either still images or videos. So you can actually put your finger on the screen of your smartphone and just pan and scan around and look at the view around you, as it were, you know, at your choice. You can decide where you look in that 360. It will do 5-megapixel 360 photos, which are, you know, good enough for that.
That's pretty good.
And it also allows you to use a VR headset, a virtual reality headset. So again, you can take a 3D picture and walk around it, which is kind of...
that must have been fun.
Yeah, no, it is fun. And the other thing I like about it is that it's got built-in Wi-Fi, this action cam, so it can stream the video that it's shooting straight out of the camera in real time as well. So again, you can see it on a large screen, you can upload these things onto YouTube and elsewhere, and it works with other action cam accessories as well.
So, and what sort of storage do you have on it?
It's got a micro SD card in it, so you can choose, you know, how much storage you've got on it, and it's not too bad on the storage. It doesn't sort of eat through it at too alarming a rate. In terms of the price, the list price, which we can ignore, is £250. I've seen it being sold for about £189. And as I say, it's quite unusual in that it's got this capability of the back-to-back cameras. And I think that's quite novel. And it's one of those technologies that once you've got it, you find ways of using it which are both creative and innovative. And I like that because it brings out the ideas in individuals. Yeah. And different people will do different things with it.
Sounds like you had fun with it.
I did, yeah. And as I say, I always have fun with gadgets, but it's nice to see ones that are sort of pushing the envelope. So it's the Kit Vision Immerse 360 Duo. And be careful, because there's one called the Immerse 360, but not Duo. It's just the one camera. So if you find one that's substantially cheaper than that, then that's probably the reason. If you do buy it from somewhere where you can return it within, you know, 30 days or 14 days or what have you. So if it doesn't meet your expectations and aspirations, then at least you can send it back and get a refund.
Can we see any of your work on it? Have you posted anything?
I haven't, because I'm actually quite a private person, so I tend not to. I post very little that's private, you know, but I suppose I could put a video up, but I haven't done so yet.
Okay, if you do, let us know. Let's go over to Simon in Derby. Simon, you've got what I think is a question that many people will be interested in, because it's about your sort of ability to extend Wi-Fi.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was I had the problem in my old house, which was about a year and a half ago, and really old Georgian house, thick walls. And the challenge was always trying to get a signal strong enough throughout all of the house. Now, I've moved to a new property. And
did you manage to do it, Simon? Did you manage to?
No, back then, no. And I was in. I wasn't on a fibre broadband either, so connectivity was a nightmare in rural Derbyshire. So I've now moved to an area with ultra high speed. I don't know if I can say the name of the company, but the one that's the fastest. And I've actually built a home office / man cave on the outside of my garage. And I want to use that to work from home and for my wife to work from home. The challenge that I have is that, one, when they hardwire in your Wi-Fi originally, you don't necessarily always know what parts of the house you're going to do it and how the signal strength is. So generally it goes in somewhere downstairs, which it has. When I get into that area, the signal drops. And although the connectivity speed's pretty good, if I'm trying to download a big file on my laptop, it's just not doing it very well. It's losing its connection. So my question really is there a way that you can amplify a Wi-Fi signal without having it hardwired into the system? Now, I'm lucky, I travel around a lot with work. I can stay in a 20-story hotel and get a great connection on the 19th floor or on the first floor.
Yeah.
There's got to be some technology that allows those of us at home, maybe in houses with really thick walls, or maybe with people who have larger homes or homes where you've got an office in an outbuilding or something, to be able to amplify that signal so that you get the best out of the service you've got without having to pay for another subscription.
Okay, Simon. So there are essentially two types of approach you can take to this. One is to strengthen that Wi-Fi signal. And you can do that either by having a stronger Wi-Fi signal in the first place, and some Wi-Fi routers are more powerful than others. Some of them have several antennas and have technology called beamforming, where they direct the beam in particular directions to devices and therefore can have greater range. There are also different types of Wi-Fi. Some standards are built for speed, others are built for durability through walls, if I can put it that way, so range. So it starts with, you know, the Wi-Fi router that you've got in the first place, but all Wi-Fi signals will be degraded by walls, particularly, you know, heavy walls or walls with high metal content. You can buy things called Wi-Fi repeaters, which you would put typically midway between the router and where you want to use the Wi-Fi, and that will pick up the signal, boost it and send it on again. So it'll
Are they good? I mean, I've tried them and sometimes they're a bit hit and miss.
So some are better than others, but again, it depends on so many factors, including the construction of your house, because there are some houses where, quite frankly, they might as well have been designed as Faraday cages, to designed to block out everything. And those houses will, by the way, often have poor mobile phone signal in them for the same reason. A lot of metal in a wall, for example, will kill the signal. It's the same as if you look at your microwave oven, if you look at the glass window at the front, if you look carefully, there's a metal mesh, like looks like a little thin chicken wire. And what that does is it stops the microwaves dead in their tracks. They can't go out through the glass and irradiate the surroundings. So some walls have got metal in them and they have that effect. So Wi-Fi repeaters exist. Some are stronger than others. Some are better than others. So first of all, have a strong Wi-Fi signal to start with on your router. Consider a repeater. The other way is to try and send the internet signal through a wire till it gets to, say, the room where you want to use the Wi-Fi, and then have that wired signal then turned into Wi-Fi at that point. And there are, in essence, there are two ways of doing that. Either you wire up the house, which is, you know, in terms of performance, the best way of doing it. But there are also devices that use the mains wiring in your home. So you get these pair of plugs, special plugs. One is plugged in near the router, so the signal is taken out, the internet signal is taken out of the router with an Ethernet cable. It plugs into one of these home plug devices. That's the generic name for them, home plug devices, and it goes there. It then shoots that internet signal down your mains wiring. You have another one of the pair in the room where you want to use it, and the internet signal comes out of there, and either you plug in an internet cable into it, or in the case of Simon, you get one that then generates a local Wi-Fi field. So it becomes a local Wi-Fi hotspot for that room or for that, you know, surrounding area. The issue is they don't always work in all houses, and they don't always work from every plug to every plug, because it depends on how your house is wired, which plugs are connected together, which ones are on the same loop or spur and which are not. But again, if you buy a pair of these devices and try them, you know, buy them in such a way that if they don't work for you, for your particular home, then you can return them. But if it works, it's a very simple solution, because it's literally as simple as plugging in a device near the router, plugging in a device in the room where you want to use the Wi-Fi, and taking a cable from the router to there, and they can work very well. They're not quite as good as a, you know, running specialist Ethernet cables all around the house, but then that's a lot more costly and disruptive to do as well.
Simon?
I'll rip it apart again.
Are you going to move house now again?
But give the.
No,
give,
I'll end up killing the wife, and you've got evidence on Radio 5 Live of me saying it.
Yeah, I couldn't recommend that, but seriously, try the home plugs.
The only issue I have is that I know that part of my house is on a separate circuit for I had the house rewired, and I know that power feed is on a separate circuit to the main house.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that will work, but it's worth a try. Thank you.
I think it is worth a try, because sometimes I've encountered it where I thought it wouldn't work and it has, and actually vice versa. So it's something of an art as well as a science. So just give it a go. because you will very quickly see, and you know, if you've bought it online or whatever, you can just return it, or you know, in a store that takes returns. And that's always my advice, is always buy things in a way that you can return them for full refund. So
cool, thank you very much.
I would do that. Good luck. But I'm sure you will find a solution to this, but it, you know, you might have to go through a couple of options to get the best one for you, and next time get them to wire up the whole house for you.
There we go, Simon. Enjoy your time in your man cave. Fevzy, quick question related to that. You talked about, you know, your router maybe changing the actual router itself. I mean, how will you know if it's not fast enough? Is it if it's not quick enough, do you just bring another one in and try it? Is there a way of finding out whether another router could help speed up the internet in your house?
You know, there are applications like Speedtest that run inside, you know, browsers. So what you could do, for example, is plug a laptop directly into the router using a cable. So that's like just, you know, going to the horse's mouth, as it were. So you've taken out of the equation how good is the Wi-Fi and how much is it being impeded by the structure of my house. If that speed is acceptable to you, what you're getting on the speed test there, then that's a good starting point, because that means, you know, the internet as it's coming into your home at that time is adequate for your needs. Then you can run a speed test over Wi-Fi in different locations in your home and see how and if that speed drops off. And you might find that there's particular dead spots and so forth. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is that Wi-Fi comes on different channels, which are very slightly different frequencies within a single band. And if there are other devices broadcasting on the same channel, then you may also be suffering from interference. We didn't talk about that before. We talked about how the structure of the property can diminish the strength of the signal. But the other thing that can diminish it, just like when you listen to the radio, it's not always because if you're having trouble listening to a station, it's not always because you're in a poor reception area per se, but it can be because, you know, there's a pirate station nearby and they're blocking
interfering with it.
Yeah. So in the same way, there are devices such as decked phones, baby monitors, microwaves, neighbors' Wi-Fi, all of those can interfere. And so one of the things that you can do, you know, free, is switch the channel that your Wi-Fi is operating on. To just experiment, you know, go through a few of the different channels and see if the performance improves. You know, it is a bit of a palaver, but the benefit of that is it's free. After that, you start thinking about, you know, a better, more robust router, or you know, these are sort of gadgets we've talked about to disseminate that Wi-Fi signal more efficiently.